You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, on September 18th, Greenpeace activists tried to board an oil drilling platform in the Arctic Sea that's owned by Gazprom. Instead, the 30 protesters were confronted and detained by members of the Russian Border Guard, who brought them to the port city of Murmansk, where they were thrown in jail. Joining me now for a look at what happened next to the group, known as the Arctic 30, is journalist Masha Gessen. She's the author of six books, including Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Her article, Northern Exposure, appears in the June issue of Harper's, and I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Wasn't there a similar incident in 1990 when Greenpeace was in the Arctic to protest nuclear testing near Novaya Zemlya? Am I pronouncing that correct? Zemlya?
Novaya Zemlya, yeah. Well, it was similar and yet not. The amazing thing was that actually some of the same people were on that mission as were on the mission last year in the Arctic. And they were indeed detained. They were towed to the port of Murmansk. And, of course, in the port of Murmansk in 1990, they were promptly released to a round of handshakes and media coverage, whereas this time they were actually jailed.
And yet you'd think that Russia would have, or then it was the Soviet Union. Was it still Russia?
It was the Soviet Union still, but it was on its way to sort of become more integrated in the world. And that incident in 1990 was a very typical Greenpeace incident, where they would get detained briefly, and then the detention would basically just result in a lot of media coverage. That's what they're used to. They're not used to these kinds of serious international incidents where essentially 30 people get kidnapped.
Is this more serious because it involves oil drilling?
I think it's more serious because it involves contemporary Russia's national interests as Russia sees it.
Is the oil drilling part of Russia's larger claim that the North Pole and large parts of the Arctic Sea are Russian?
Absolutely. That's the whole point. I mean, the oil drilling in the Arctic at this point is incredibly inefficient. It's horribly expensive. The cost of getting a barrel of oil out of the seabed there is about five times what it can fetch on the market. So it's a symbolic gesture to lay claim to the territory.
Now, that's interesting to me because Russia is essentially a petroleum state these days. You'd think that they would have figured out how to drill for oil.
Well, they will figure it out eventually if they continue doing that in the Arctic.
But their environmental record is pretty bad.
Russia is an empire more than it is a petroleum state. And I think that's what makes this story very interesting for me, is that it's really more a story about Russia's national identity and Russia's national ambition rather than the oil drilling.
Well, before the incident in last September, Greenpeace had staged a similar smaller protest the summer of 2012. And that one went fairly smoothly, didn't it?
That one, I think, caught the Russians by surprise in a way. They didn't know what to do with the protesters. But what I think Greenpeace didn't realize was that Russia was evolving very quickly in its attitude toward protest itself at that time. This was August 2012, was when the political crackdown was just beginning, when the protest movement was being killed in Russia proper, when Pussy Riot were on trial during the very same days that Greenpeace was protesting in the Arctic. And so what they didn't realize is that they were catching this moment in development, and that it was actually going to be very different when they went back a year later.
And what was the official reason for the protest?
The reason for the protest was to bear witness to oil drilling in the Arctic and to draw attention to the environmental danger of oil drilling in the Arctic.
And where exactly was the oil drilling platform that they were protesting?
Right. Well, that's a key point of contention. That's the oil drilling platform is actually in international waters. It's Russia's exclusive economic zone, which means that only Russia can engage in economic activity there. But it is not actually Russian territory, which is something that, as I found, Russian prosecutors and Russian police had a really difficult time wrapping their minds around.
Well, this is a Dutch-registered ship, the Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise. Didn't it remain in international waters during the entire encounter?
Well, until it was taken hostage and towed to Murmansk, it was in international waters. So that's why I keep referring to this as a kidnapping, because basically Russia had no authority to arrest these people or arrest this ship.
But the platform is owned and operated by a subsidiary of Gazprom, not the Russian Federation itself. Was that a distinction that was lost on many Russian officials?
I think it very much was that, and there was an incredible moment in court when one of the defense attorneys addressed the prosecutor and said, the prosecutor may not realize that this is not Russian state territory. This is private property. And the prosecutor sort of mumbled and said, but wait a second, it is our job to protect Russian property wherever it is. And I think there may have been, if realtors in London or New York had heard this, they might have shuddered.
Was that because the national interest and Gazprom's interests are almost the same, at least in the minds of the Russian government?
Absolutely. And I think that was sort of a heartbreaking detail in the story as well, was that Greenpeace thought that they could negotiate the release of these activists. And they were hoping very much that they could give Putin an exit strategy, an expression that we've heard a lot lately, because he could pretend that it was business that kidnapped these people and then the state could interfere. And of course, it wasn't business. The state and business are inseparable.
My guest is Masha Gessen, whose article Northern Exposure. Appears in the June issue of Harper's. Eight of the people on the Dutch ship spoke Russian, and yet they made a point of communicating in English with the Russian authorities. Why?
I think it was sort of a psychological device that maybe was more useful to the activists ultimately than to the actual negotiations. But they felt like if they were there as international activists and if they were in international waters, the communication should be in English.
Well, was the Russian approach to the protesters unusually aggressive in situations like these?
It was unusually aggressive for Greenpeace. Greenpeace is not used to this sort of thing. This is really, in the entire history of Greenpeace, this is probably the second truly serious incident. And the first would be when France blew up a Greenpeace ship in the port of New Zealand, I believe in the late 1980s. Amazingly, the captain of the ship back then was the same as the captain of this ship now.
I would not go on a ship that he was captaining.
He's captained a lot of ships in the interim.
The Russians stripped the ship of much of its equipment. I guess that was a way of saying you're never going to do this again.
Well, that's what we're told. I don't know if that's what the activists say. We still haven't seen the ship. No one has seen the ship except for the Russian authorities, even though there's an international court decision that says that Russia has to release the ship. But it's still in Murmansk. But the activists say that, yes, they stripped it of a lot of the equipment, and a lot of it seems to have been just looting.
One member of what would come to be called the Arctic 30, Dima Litvinov, had been part of the 1990 protests. He also came from a long line of Russian dissidents. Was he one of the protesters who were communicating with the border guard?
He was the chief negotiator. He did most of the talking. So he was in this very strange position of speaking English to them, but hearing what they were saying to each other in Russian and understanding it perfectly well.
And did they know that that was the case?
I'm not sure. I think they may have suspected that they could be understood, but I also have a feeling they didn't care. It's very clear from what he says about the negotiations that their purpose was not to communicate. Their purpose was to seize the ship.
After forcing two of the protesters who had started scaling the outside of the oil drilling platform to descend onto a Russian border guard ship, they then demanded to board the Arctic Sunrise and threatened to open fire if they were refused. Was there any sense that these Russian border guards realized that they were, in effect, threatening to declare war by international law?
They don't seem to have understood that. Dima Litvinov, the negotiator, pointed that out to them.
He said they'd be declaring war on the Netherlands.
Yes. He also hilariously pointed out that it was the year of cultural friendship between the Netherlands and Russia. And he thinks that they actually later got word from Moscow that they shouldn't open fire on the ship itself. So there was a lot of shooting. There was a lot of shooting into the air and into the water, but apparently no shooting at the actual ship.
And then the Russian border guard called in a helicopter. Why that? Weren't they prepared just to take these people off on their own ship?
Well, no, they called in a helicopter to actually board the ship. So they descended onto the ship from the air. And there's actually a dramatic videotape that can be found online. And you see the helicopter hovering over the ship. And you see the Greenpeace activists running out onto deck. and trying to sort of trying to place themselves arms up in a w- so that to prevent the helicopter from landing on the deck. And it looks almost like a ritual dance, which it may as well be, because, of course, they're descending by rope. And within seconds, they're right there next to the activists.
How long did it take for the protesters, the Russian Border Guard and the Arctic Sunrise to make it to the port of Murmansk?
I believe it was 4 or 5 days. It was a little longer than it should have taken because they were being towed. They thought that once they got to Murmansk, they would be released and the whole incident would be resolved. And the dramatic moment sort of came when a defense attorney came to them and said, you're being charged with piracy, and that's 10 to 15 years.
And you say that one of the most curious legal documents in this case is the protocol of detention.
Right, because according to the protocol, they were detained in Murmansk. In fact, in the building of the investigative committee in Murmansk. And there is no indication of how they landed in this building, because, of course, most of them did not have Russian visas, or none of them had Russian visas. Most of them required Russian visas to enter the country, with the exception of the 4 Russian citizens who were there. So, you know, these aliens sort of make landing at the investigative committee and are promptly booked there.
One of the 30 people who were arrested was a freelance photographer named Denis Sinyakov. Why was his arrest so shocking to the other journalists?
I think it was fascinating for me because I was just then finishing up my book about Pussy Riot, and his picture is on the cover. He's a terrific photographer, and he does a lot of documenting of contemporary Russian protest culture. So it was no accident that he was there. What was shocking was that it was the first time that a journalist was treated exactly as the activists were. There have been incidents when journalists were hauled into the police along with the protesters and then released as soon as the others were booked. But it's never been the case that somebody was treated precisely and very pointedly as the activists. And in a way, that's sort of a declaration of war on the protesters. It's the message is you're going to be treated as the side on which you find yourself in that at that particular moment.
So also, these people were being charged with piracy. Now, I'm not sure how piracy applies to something like this. Would they have had a difficult time making that stick?
They probably would have, which is probably why they dropped the piracy charge and replaced it with a hooliganism charge once the case was launched in the International Tribunal on the Law of the Seas. But piracy, hilariously, in Russian law, is defined as an attack on a ship that is undertaken with the use of weapons and with the purpose of seizing possessions. Now, of course, that is exactly what the Russian ship did. They attacked the Greenpeace ship with the use of weapons, and they actually took a lot of the possessions. The Greenpeace activists didn't do that by any stretch of the imagination. They actually tried to scale a stationary platform, which is not a ship. And for the purposes of law, that's a very meaningful distinction. And they had no weapons, and they took nothing.
And in the end, they were eventually charged with felony hooliganism, the same charge that was used in the trial of the members of the Pussy Riot.
Exactly.
Is that the default crime for the Russian government to charge when it doesn't like something?
Yes, and it's very telling. The way that the charge sounds is, the way it's worded, is a crude disturbance of the social order. So that's what Pussy Riot did when they entered the Cathedral of Christ the Savior and sang there. And that's apparently what Greenpeace did. It's a little more difficult to wrap your mind around because, of course, what social order there is in the open seas is sort of open to debate.
My guess is Masha Gessen, who's written an article for the June issue of Harper's called Northern Exposure. The Dutch government also got involved and filed a claim in the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. Was that in response to lobbying by Greenpeace?
Yes. It took actually quite a lot of work to get the Dutch government to go to court against Russia.
Why would they have been reluctant? After all, it is a Dutch ship.
It is a Dutch ship. But the Netherlands has been one of the sort of most appeasing countries of Europe toward Russia. The Netherlands is almost entirely dependent on Russian gas for all its energy use. The Netherlands is the only country that did not stage a de facto political boycott, the only Western country, a de facto political boycott of the Sochi Olympics. The Dutch king and the Dutch prime minister both attended the games. So,
and what about, what was their reaction to Crimea?
You know what? I don't know, but I think they've stayed fairly quiet on Crimea. I mean, the Netherlands have really gone out of their way to maintain good relations with Russia. So I think they would have preferred to ignore the fact that a Dutch ship had been taken hostage by the Russian authorities. But that's a very difficult thing to ignore, especially for a seafaring country like the Netherlands.
Did Russia have a good track record of cooperating with the tribunal?
Well, the tribunal is a small international court. It hasn't had that many cases. I think it's like four dozen cases in its entire history. Not a lot of them have involved Russia. Russia is one of the conveners of the court, and so there was every expectation that Russia would respond to the charges and at least try to argue them in court, and that would bring it into a sort of civilized arena. Russia shocked observers by refusing to participate in the proceedings and essentially deciding unilaterally to stop recognizing the court.
You visited Murmansk while the Arctic 30 were being held there. What kind of operation did Greenpeace have in place to try to support the activists who'd been arrested?
It was pretty amazing. Within days of their arrest, they had about 30 people on the ground in Murmansk. They were all there on tourist visas, so they were all there as volunteers and sort of passing through very briefly. But it was, I think it was called a duty of care operation, and the idea was to supply the Greenpeace prisoners with warm clothing, with food, with everything that they needed, which was basically a full-time operation for 30 people.
Well, when they were put in pretrial detention centers, most of the protesters ended up in what's known as the Black Zone. A black zone. What's a black zone?
Right. Well, that's that was an interesting introduction to Russian culture for a lot of these foreigners. Russian prisons can be one of two kinds. The red zones is where the prison administration imposes its rules, and they can be arbitrary, but at least it's the police, the prison administration that rules there. The black zones are really bizarre places that are essentially prisoner run. Prison colonies or jails. There are not a lot of them left in Russia. In the 90s, it used to be most of them. But the administration sort of doesn't intervene, and the prisoners create their own hierarchies. The rules tend to be convoluted, often very ritualistic, very, very difficult to understand for people who don't speak Russian. Like, for example, Captain Wilcox, who was the captain of the ship, who's an American, got into a lot of trouble for throwing out a piece of moldy bread.
So what's the significance of sending them to a black zone prison?
I don't think there was any particular significance to that.
Having them be aware of how many people have tattoos in those kinds of prisons.
No, I think that's where they had the space. That they just had the bad luck of landing in Murmansk.
And then they were transferred to St. Petersburg. Was that where they were expected to stand trial?
It was where they were initially expected to stand trial, but then as Putin scrambled to sort of clean up his human rights image just before the Olympics, when it became clear that a lot of Western countries were going to politically boycott the Games, they became the beneficiaries. All 30 people were amnestied and released, essentially kicked out of Russia very, very quickly to sort of avoid any kind of international incident, any further international incident.
Why was Captain Wilcox not supposed to throw out a piece of moldy bread?
Well, that's a great question.
Were they looking for penicillin?
It's one of those convoluted rules. Bread is sacred. It is not to be thrown into the waste. So I think it's let it sit around and dry or whatever.
So what do you think would have happened if the Olympic Games were not coming up at Sochi? Do you think that they might have been found guilty and sent to prison the way Pussy Riot was?
I think there's a very good chance that they would have stood trial. It's hard to do counterfactual, but my prediction would have been that they would stand trial, that the Russian citizens would go to jail for 2 or 3 years, and that the foreigners would be convicted and then deported.
Some of the protesters wanted to refuse the amnesty and stand trial instead. Why did the Russian authorities pressure them to take the deal?
Well, a lot of this happens just because the orders come from the top. So once the orders were no longer to hold them in prison, but quite the opposite, to get rid of them as fast as possible, the local authorities just had to get rid of them as fast as possible. But really, the decision was taken so that that incident would be over, so that Russians wouldn't have to face criticism during the Olympic Games for holding a bunch of foreign citizens who, again, had been kidnapped in international waters.
Well, we're talking about territorial claims, and we've seen other territorial claims made since. In fact, it's still going on. Crimea really helped boost President Putin's popularity. Did this do anything to help him?
It wasn't a high-profile enough story, but you're absolutely right. It is part of the same phenomenon. And I was, I reported the entire story and actually submitted it before the Crimean invasion, but I realized that the story is so much easier to understand for Americans now that that Crimea has happened.
Well, Pussy Riot got a lot of attention in this country, and they were released also as part of this amnesty bill. But the Arctic 30 got less attention. Why do you think that is?
I don't have an answer to that because I think it's mind-boggling. I think it is absolutely mind-boggling that 30 citizens of 18 different countries, including two American citizens, are kidnapped by armed Russian men in international waters and thrown into Russian jails. And the United States media and United States activists and the United States government is not shouting about it on every street corner. I find that unbelievable.
And now that there is no longer the pressure of Olympic Games, and international attention has gone elsewhere, has there been another crackdown in Russia?
The crackdown has intensified significantly since the end of the games, which coincided with the beginning of the war in Ukraine. And I think I think that's the right way of putting it. It is a war between Russia and Ukraine at this point, and Russia is very much cracking down according to the rules of wartime. So cracking down in the opposition, cracking down in independent media, and I think a death watch is in order for independent media at this point.
I'm sure this would just be conjecture on your part, but I've been wondering why Vladimir Putin seems to be pulling back on the pressure that he's applied to Ukraine.
I think he does not have a grand strategic plan. He wanted to cause turmoil in Ukraine. He succeeded in doing that. Blood is being shed
at this very moment,
without his participation. He doesn't actually need to annex eastern Ukraine. What he wanted to do is he wanted to annex Crimea, which he did. And now he has actually a vast repertoire that has developed over the years of what to do with other territories that he wants to cause unrest in.
And some people have pointed out that annexing Crimea and perhaps eastern Ukraine would cause a lot of problems, actually, because these are really depressed areas. And Russia would have to send a lot of money, which it doesn't seem to have, into those areas to put them back into shape. But do you see this as part, and I'm including the Arctic 30 incident, as an expansionist plan on Putin's part?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the distinction between sort of strategic oil exploration and territorial claims, and territorial claims are much more important in the Arctic. And the same here. Yes, economically, Crimea does not benefit Russia. In fact, this whole Ukrainian adventure economically is a huge blow to Russia. But in terms of Putin's popularity, it's a boost. And in terms of his self-identity and the identity of Russia, which sort of follows suit, it's a huge boost. And that's what he's concerned with.
Well, Russia has always been engaged in expansionist policies going back way before there was a Soviet Union.
Absolutely. And I think that's very much his psychology. Is he's made many references in his public speeches about Ukraine. He's made many references to pre-revolutionary Russia. That's what he clearly now is now seeing himself as an heir to, is Tsarist Russia, the Russian Empire.
Masha Gessen's article, Northern Exposure, Protest, Petroleum, and Putin's Dream of a Russian Arctic, is in the June issue of Harper's. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me.